during the course of the afternoon, with some heavier and more persistent rain and strengthening winds too. Strongest winds will be around Irish Sea coast, and then we'll all get a spell of rain tomorrow night, and that's going to leave us on Saturday with sunshine and some showers.
All right, many thanks, Darren Bett. Now we continue our book of the week, An Englishman Abroad Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Charles Timony. In his journey down the River Seine in the rowing boat he has built himself, Charles and his wife Innes have reached Paris. Now they embark on the next stage of their journey in the boat. But first, Charles has a meeting with a friend downstream from Paris to find out about the fish in the river. The reader is Mark Heap.
Stéphane is a carp fisherman. He catches the fish with care, measures it, weighs it, photographs himself with it, and then very carefully returns it to the water. It is Stéphane's proud boast that he always gives each fish he catches a kiss before returning it to the water. I'm fairly sure not all fishermen do this. When we met, he launched straight into an enthusiastic description of enormous carp and huge catfish. It seems that while I was innocently tootling along this part of the river, these enormous fish were lurking in the water right beneath me, just like the shark in Jaws. The largest catfish caught in the Seine can measure up to 2.5 metres in length. I have no idea whether carp or catfish jump out of the water, but if one suddenly decided to do so while someone was rowing past, it could sink the boat with no problem at all. I seem to remember Stéphane saying that catfish are carnivorous, but it is possible that the beer and saucisson may have clouded my memory. Innes turned up as Stéphane was getting his rods ready to start fishing. It became quickly clear to both of us that he would rather be left to do this on his own, so we piled into our boat and set off downstream. When upstream, we'd met very few boats on the river. Here, we came across one almost as soon as we'd left Stéphane. It was a small sailing dinghy crewed by what seemed to be a couple in late middle age. They spent some time happily, though somewhat inexpertly, sailing up and down our stretch of the river, exchanging a few friendly words with us each time they passed, before heading off round the next bend. A few minutes later, the sailing dinghy reappeared around a bend 100 or so metres away and swung round to carry on up the river towards us. As it did so, it jibed dramatically, clearly to the complete astonishment of its crew. The boom slammed over to the opposite side with such force that the dinghy started to heel over, until, finally, it capsized, flinging them into the water under the sail. What you should never, ever do is to stay on the sail side and try and get back into the boat from there. Unfortunately, this, we were fascinated to see, was exactly what the duo set out to do. Together, in what passed for a frantic scramble for participants who were old, stiff, cold, and wet, they tried to pull themselves back aboard the boat the wrong way. But it didn't work. All that happened was that they turned the whole thing right upside down and got a second ducking for their pains. I bent to my oars. I've been longing to say that. Reaching their boat, we realised that the couple were a fair bit older than we had thought and seemed to have given up completely. They were just floating there in their life jackets. Always keen to avoid being accused of piracy, I asked, "Est-ce que je peux monter à bord?" Permission to come aboard? Visibly shaking himself into some degree of alertness, the man muttered, "Seul un Anglais poserait une question pareille à un tel moment." Only an Englishman would ask a question like that at a time like this. Once the boat was upright, the accursed thing tried to sail away all by itself. I managed to bring it head to wind a few yards from our two chilly pieces of flotsam. "C'est bon, vous pouvez monter à bord." "It's okay now, you can climb back in," I called to them a couple of minutes later. But they didn't react at all. As I was a fair bit colder and wetter than I had envisaged when I got up that morning, I felt justified in telling them rather sharply to "secouez-vous!" snap out of it and swim over to the stern. This they listlessly did until they were both hanging on the transom like elderly seals waiting to be fed. We heaved each of them into the boat, helped by Ines intoning, "Oh, hiss," like a seaman toiling on a rope. The couple were now lying like two recently caught tuna fish, side by side in the bottom of the boat. As they were struggling upright, we put the main sheet into the man's hand and climbed back into our boat. I fear I may even have patted him on the head as we left. We were both somewhat damp about the feet and legs after the rescue, so I put Ines ashore so that she could walk back to the car. We agreed to meet up further down the river in Saint-Germain-en-Laye. A few hundred metres on, the entire character of the river changed alarmingly. I suddenly found myself on a stretch of water a good 150 metres wide, and, what's more, there were waves. And the current was much stronger. The first real test of the boat's seaworthiness wasn't long in coming. Racing round the end of the island towards me came a huge bulk carrier barge, so heavily laden its gunwales were almost awash. The best idea seemed to be to get as close to the shore as possible, even though it was an unwelcoming, steep, concrete wall. As the barge drew level, I turned the boat round so that it would be pointing straight at the approaching wake. Painfully gained experience over the years has shown me that wakes, like problems, should always be confronted head-on. The boat pitched and bounced alarmingly, and I hadn't bargained on there being a rebound. When it reached the concrete wall, each wave of the wake bounced back and set off again back across the river, but at an angle to the way it had arrived. This meant that as well as the waves coming from the front, which were making the boat pitch up and down, I was unexpectedly flung about from side to side by a load of new waves appearing from the shore. Three more barges went by before I reached the quay in Le Pec, where, thankfully, Ines was waiting for me. Summer was almost over. I realised that what I needed was to find a complete stranger who was not only planning on travelling along the last part of the Seine downstream of Paris, but also could be persuaded to do so in the company of an unknown Englishman. I posted an ad on a barge user's website. English writer would like to hitch down the Seine. And at last came a reply from someone called Serge, who had a 28-metre barge near Herblay and said that he would happily take me for a trip downriver. We set off at a comfortable 10 kilometres per hour, a speed that covers distances steadily while allowing you plenty of time to look at the view. Groups of attractive houses were interspersed with trees and even stretches of woodland, despite the fact that we weren't far from central Paris. As we were passing a village spread out along the quayside, I realised that it was Conflans-Sainte-Honorine, somewhere I know quite well. Seeing a place from the river makes you realise that the impression you get of a town as you walk or drive through it is completely different from the one you get from the water. As we passed Conflans, I could see the shapes of the houses that lie along the waterfront, as well as the way in which the streets adapt themselves to the hill that rises away from the river. I shall look at it differently next time we go there. The next weekend was the Journée de l'Habitat Fluvial in Paris, a kind of bargee's jamboree. A large expanse of quayside had been given over to stalls for all things that are of interest to barge folk: boat insurance, boat builders, and VHF radio manufacturers. The stall that really caught my attention was the one with the propellers. Barge propellers being sizeable objects, they'd all been set out on the ground in front of the stall. The one I fell in love with was the size of a dinner table. It was made from gleaming golden bronze and had five perfectly curved blades instead of the usual four. I was squatting down, stroking the propeller, and imagining how nice it would look on our coffee table, when the charming girl on the stall asked Ines the standard stallholder's question. "Vous avez un bateau?" Ines decided to explain that her husband had built a wooden rowing boat. Now, it's important to note that I hadn't said anything at all at this point. The girl looked me up and down, shaking her head slightly, and asked Ines in that all too common pitying tone, "Il est anglais?" Is he English? How? How did she do that? " Time was moving on. The Seine, downstream of Paris, is alarmingly broad and too dangerous for small rowing boats. But I had failed so far to find anyone else to take me the rest of the way down to Le Havre in a bigger boat. So, it was my boat or nothing. I would follow the river and look for stretches which would prove welcoming for small boats. We rejoined the river at Les Mureaux, below Paris, and followed it as best we could. Beyond Les Mureaux, it didn't look encouraging. Barges of all sorts were thundering in both directions, while the bank was unattractively adorned with oil storage tanks and the scars of heavy industry. A little further on was the huge power station at Porcheville. I couldn't say I fancied rowing past a power station, not least because it was one of the ugliest things along the river. We pushed on to La Roche-Guyon, where we were going to stop for the night. By the time we'd finished supper, it had got completely dark. I was suddenly struck by the realisation that I had never rowed the boat in the dark, so we carried the boat to the water's edge. After a couple of minutes, our eyes got used to the dark, and we realised that even in complete darkness, you can somehow still see the river. There is a sheen to the water, which means you can always tell where the river stops and the bank begins. I went back to fetch a life jacket and a length of rope from the car. Sitting alone in the dark, in a small boat, on a huge expanse of unfamiliar water, is an unsettling experience. As your eyes have little to contribute, all your other senses start clamouring for your attention. I first noticed the smell. The river had a slightly oozy odour that probably came from its muddy banks, but the sense that really started working overtime in the dark was my hearing. A quietly flowing river makes far more noise at night than it does in the daytime. You can hear the water itself, whether it is the ripples against the shore, the soft lapping against the hull, or the drips falling from the oars. You start to notice other noises, rustles from the bank, and the odd, unexplained splashes. Reason says that the noises near the shore must just be water voles or frogs or some other small creature of the night. But what about the splashes quite close to me? Do fish jump at night? What else could be splashing about near me? A slight change of plan seemed in order, so I called out, and when Ines answered, I rowed briskly back towards the sound of her voice. I tied the long rope to the boat and gave Ines the other end to hold. Now, there was no question of it being a lifeline, the very idea. It was just a means to prevent me from inadvertently rowing too far away and worrying her unnecessarily. Once back out on the water, I was able to potter about at the end of the rope. The main thing you notice is that the simple act of rowing itself is surprisingly noisy. It wasn't that the rowlocks squeaked, it was the movement of the oars between the jaws of the rowlocks that made the noise. I now realised what they meant in the hornblower books when they talked about muffling the oars of a boat when out on a night raid. All you have to do to deaden the noise is put some cloth wadded up between the oars and the rowlocks. That worked a treat. Apart from the sound of the water dripping off the oars, I could then row slowly about without making a sound. This was surprisingly entertaining, and kept me amused until it was time to head off to bed.
Episode 4 of An Englishman Abroad, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Charles Timoney, was read by Mark Heap, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Now, here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast.
Thank you.
Now, on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday, the 14th of June. There are warnings of gales in Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Faroes 994, slow moving, losing its identity. New low expected Rockall 991 by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Northwest Viking, southwesterly 5 to 7, backing southerly 4 later, showers good. Southeast Viking, North Tsera, South Tsera, northeast 40s. Westerly or southwesterly 4 or 5, showers good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, 4th Tyne, Dogger. Southwest.